all owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. Freedom is defined as the power or right to act, speak, or think as one wants without hindrance or restraint. If you're within reach of this radio signal, you enjoy the benefits of freedom and liberty. Based upon our website data, I feel comfortable saying that somewhere in the world, a person or two have heard this show. Persons who don't fully enjoy those freedoms. That breaks my heart, but maybe not just for the reason you might imagine. Of course, I regret the fact that they do not enjoy the same freedoms we do. But perhaps even more sorrowful for me is that far too many of our fellow citizens so often overlook the benefits of our freedoms, bought and paid for by the blood of our military men and women. You don't know how good something can be until it is taken away. Imagine if your freedoms were taken away for 2,103 days. And I'm not just talking about high-minded concepts. I'm talking about basic things like being able to bathe, eat, and the reassurance of something as mundane as a latch on the inside of the door so that you can open it. Our guest today has been on the negative side of that equation for nearly 6 years. Charlie Plum was at the top of his game, one of the Navy's best. He was flying the hottest airplane in the world and had flown as an aggressor pilot in the program that would become the Navy's fabled Top Gun program. 10 foot tall and bulletproof, he didn't think the enemy had a gun big enough to shoot down Charlie Plum. Charlie had 74 combat missions under his belt and was 5 days away from ending his tour of duty in Vietnam. Today he joins us on American Warrior Radio to fill us in on, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story. Welcome to American Warrior Radio, Captain Charlie Plum.
Hello, Ben. Thanks, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Charlie, I tell you what, I'm so much looking forward to our chat today. I know you didn't expect a quiz, but you're a very bright, accomplished guy. So as I was prepping for this show, Charlie, it's the numbers of POWs in Vietnam. It's kind of a hard number to pin down, maybe for obvious reasons, but of the members of our military and civilian community that served as POWs in Vietnam, what is that number to the best of your knowledge? 591, 592, more or less?
591 of us came home.
Okay.
And it is a little bit difficult because a couple of those guys were in China, and so were they Vietnam POWs, not exactly, but they were flying and they went across the border and were captured and held in China. Some of the POWs, of course, were not American. We had Thai and we had South Vietnamese POWs there as well. So sometimes you see that in the number, but the best number that I know is 591.
Okay, fair enough. And I tell you, the data I can find that is pretty good, there are still 1,587 members who still remain unaccounted for from that war. Charlie, two sides of today's talk. I want to talk about your time in the prisoner of war camp and your time afterwards because there's lessons in both and they connect. But in your book, I'm No Hero, I tell you, it's a combination of the horrific, the inspirational, and just plain amazing stuff, sir. When did you decide to put your thoughts down on paper? What was the trigger for that?
When I first came home in 1973, I had really no intent at all for ever telling my story to anybody. My sister's brother-in-law, who I knew fairly well, was an English teacher, and he said, "You got to tell this story." Well, I was very reluctant at first, and until he said, "You know, everybody's asking all these questions," and they were. I came back to my parents' home in the Kansas City area, and I was on all the media, front page of the newspapers, and television, and all this stuff. And so I was kind of the hometown hero, and everybody was asking me these questions. And so this brother of my brother-in-law said, "Hey, we'll make it easy. Just write down the story. When somebody asks you the question, just give them the book." Well, that didn't work very well. I give people the book, and they just kept asking me more questions. And here, what, 47 years later, they're still asking me questions. So that was the impetus of writing my book.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I was saying it's a tremendous read. I really enjoyed it. I encourage people to get it.
Thank you for that. And I autograph every copy that's ordered on my website. So if folks want an autographed copy, I'd be happy to do that.
Even better.
Yeah.
Charlie, I tell you, one thing that jumped out at me right off the bat in the early pages of recounting your story in your book, I'm No Hero, was something maybe it happened more often than I'm aware, but it really struck me after you and your fellow, I guess he'd be would that be a Rio?
Yes.
And an F4 were shot down. You actually waved off any rescue, if I'm interpreting that correctly.
I did, as a matter of fact. Had I been closer to the ocean and a rescue might have been possible, I probably would not have done that, but I was well inland. I was shot down just south of Hanoi, and at the time was the most heavily defended city in the world. And so to get a chopper in there to rescue me would more than likely get the chopper shot down and kill that crew. And so it wasn't even a question in my mind that I didn't want anybody else exposed to that. I was on my own.
And you were taken into captured pretty darn quick.
Immediately. In fact, they were shooting at me as I came down. They were waiting for me on the ground. And so there was no escape at all.
Now, were these, Charlie, some of those infamous North Vietnamese villagers that had the ability to down an F-4 Phantom with nothing but a musket and a sharp knife?
That's pretty true. What got me was the surface-to-air missile, but any of the guys that were going in low, they could actually be brought down by a rifle bullet. And so, yes, the people who captured me from the beginning were just villagers, just peasants and farmers. I landed in a rice paddy, and so they came out and captured me there.
Charlie, I want to spend the next few minutes just talking and pulling some kernels out of your book, because kernels as in wisdom, not kernel as in birds on the shoulder. Want to clarify
okay.
that. But and by the way, to translate, Charlie, just so for some of our civilian listeners know, a captain in the Navy is the equivalent of a colonel in the Air Force or Army.
True.
Okay.
In addition, that the RIO that you mentioned was actually my backseater, is a co-pilot, really, but had no control of the airplane. He just had a radar back there, so we call him RIO, Radar Intercept Officer.
Well, I tell you, Charlie, I what really jumped out at me from your book were just, it's replete with examples, and this is the amazing part that I mentioned before, of the power of the human mind when coupled with desperation and a strong spirit. Your communication systems that you developed, the things you literally invented. I mean, literally with, who's the guy on TV that used to be able to make an aircraft carrier out of some duct tape and a paperclip?
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You were the
MacGyver.
Yeah, you guys were real-life MacGyvers. Tell us about your first experience with what I call the wire tug.
Well, you're absolutely right. And the secret to that, and it seems amazing to people that we could make these things, and communicate the way we did, but the secret that people really have trouble understanding is that we had 24/7 with nothing, absolutely nothing to do. They gave us no books to read, no window to look out, no TV, telephone, nothing. And so when you are bereft of all of the inputs in your senses, suddenly you get very creative. So I was alone in my solitary confinement cell for the first several weeks, and feeling sorry for myself, blaming the president that started the war, blaming the mechanic that put my airplane together, blaming anybody I could blame, and I felt very guilty for having given up. You know, fighter pilots are not trained to give up. That's not in our DNA. And I remember thinking, how in the world can I go back to my country my family, my fellow fighter pilots, and admit that I'd failed so miserably. In fact, at one point I thought maybe I won't go back to the United States. You know, maybe I'll find some place else to live when I'm released, because I felt so guilty about what I had done. And I'm pacing my 8-foot by 8-foot prison cell. A couple hundred miles, I guess, went by, and I heard a cricket in the far corner of my prison cell. Well, I walked over to check it out, and it wasn't the cricket. It was a little wire that was coming through a hole at the base of that cell wall and scratching on my concrete floor, making this chirping noise. Well, I reached down and tugged on the wire, and it tugged back, and the second time I tugged, it disappeared right back through that rat hole. It came back about an hour later with a note wrapped around the end of it. This note wrapped around this wire was written on a dirty piece of toilet paper, and I could barely make it out. But it said, memorize this code, then eat this note. Well, I did it. I memorized the code, ate the note. The code was a series of numbers to represent various letters of the alphabet or abbreviations. And it was very cumbersome code, very slow, but it was my link to the world. It was a lifesaver. So I started to communicate with the guy on the other end. And it was Lieutenant Commander Bob Shoemaker. Now, Shoe was an F-8 pilot and Navy pilot. He had been chosen for the astronaut program. This is in the late 60s, and I had also applied for astronaut, and I was in the beginning phases of that. So he had been there for 2 years when I showed up. He'd been piecing together little bits of wire, stuffing them out a hole in his cell wall across a storeroom between our two prison cells. It was unbelievable. He fished that little wire over the boxes and through the ropes and around the shovels and into the little hole in my cell wall, 14 feet away.
Wow.
So we started to communicate. And I found that communication was going to be the salvation of my life and the other guys as well.
I tell you, Charlie, let's take a break. Sounds like you got to answer the phone there. You've probably got a fan calling already. Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about how Charlie Plum started to improve the communication there in that POW camp. Folks, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We've got Charlie Plum, who is a peach of a guest. Did you see what I did there, Charlie?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. It's probably not the first time you've heard that. Thanks to our friends at Bravo 748 Military and Veterans Speakers Bureau. If you're looking for someone to come speak at your event, I tell you, they've got just some amazing folks like our guest today, Charlie Plum. Charlie, we're talking a little bit about, to me, the amazing part of your book and your story is the technology. You were describing how you started off with this code that this other pilot had developed, but pretty soon, I mean, you were learned in the ways of Morse code, and I'm guessing in those days, a lot of at least the Navy folks, probably also understood that. So did that turn out to be a more efficient way of communicating once you figure out a way to do the dots and dashes?
It certainly was, Ben, and that was the issue. For instance, on the wire, we couldn't distinguish a dot from a dash, only a series of tugs. And that was the way with a lot of the communication technique, and we had 1,000 ways to communicate. When a guy would get outside to chop wood for the fire, he could chop in these numbers, and the whole camp could hear the chopping. It was like a radio station. But we eventually, if you had a common wall with another prisoner of war, you could tap a dot and wrap the dash, and so it became much faster. As pilots, we all knew Morse code, and so we got pretty proficient at just tapping and wrapping on the wall.
And Charlie, that's what amazed me about the mind and given. You're in your fellow POW circumstances, And I think in your book you talked about even when people were out hoeing the garden, they would hoe in a rhythmic sequence that was actually communicating a message to other prisoners.
That's right.
Wow.
We even developed a system where vocal sounds, coughs and sneezes, spits and wheezes, could represent various letters of the alphabet. And so, you know, most of the enemy had tuberculosis, and they sort of assumed that we did too, and they paid no attention when we go around coughing and wheezing and spitting mm-hmm. and sneezing, and it was a crazy sounding way to communicate.
Now, Charlie, I'm not proud to admit this, but I will be honest, I've been in some pretty seedy places over the course of my life, but I tell you what, brother, you win the award for the seediest, stinkiest post office ever.
It was where we dumped our buckets. Okay, every cell had about a 2 gallon bucket. That was our toilet. And usually it was rusted out at the top and no lid on it and stunk to high heaven. But about every 2 or 3 or 4 days, kind of depending on the guards, we get to go dump this bucket. Well, the place we call it the sewer house, because it was kind of a brick structure, maybe 10 feet on each side. And in the end, there was a hole in the ground where you dumped your bucket. And so... You're absolutely right. It was a pretty seedy place in there. Now, the good news was the guards would not follow us into that stench. It was so terrible in there, you had to hold your breath, and the guards hated it even more than we did. And so they were watching us 24/7. It was the only time that you were not observed by a guard was when you're inside this toilet, this dump. And so we decided, hey, it's a natural. We'll make a communication system out of this place. And so we designated various cracks between the bricks to be P.O. boxes. And so everybody knew their cell was, 14 bricks to the right. And so we'd write notes on pieces of toilet paper, like that first one I got, in ink made from ashes or brick dust and a quill pen chiseled out by a stick of bamboo. And we'd write these notes out, fold the note up, put in our belt loop, and carry our bucket into this house. So we would dump our bucket in the sewer house and take our note and put it in the slot that the person we were sending it to, pick up our mail, put it in our belt loop, and proudly walk out. So it was pretty cool.
Well, in retrospect, it was probably pretty cool. But
yeah.
In your book, you use this quote, and I don't know if this is some good old Kansas wisdom or if you made this up. You said that boredom would come visit like a bill collector, I think is the phrase. And tell us about the importance of maintaining stimulation to one's mind, and particularly how bored you were. I mean, you guys came up with all sorts of games. The one that made me kind of smile, I guess you guys had would compare who had the longest fall or parachute deployment from leaving their aircraft to the ground. And the winner actually was another Navy person, a sailor, as I recall, and he had a pretty short ejection, right?
He fell out of his ship.
Well, there you go.
Doug Hegdahl was a seaman on the cruiser Canberra in the middle of the night, and he fell off that ship and got washed ashore. So, yeah, we had the high, fast, low, slow contest, and we were talking, fighter pilots and who ejected the highest and who went out the lowest and who went out the fastest. And so we played that game. Well, Doug Hegdahl won with falling off his ship 12 feet at 15 knots was his record.
That's pretty low and pretty slow. Yeah, compared to how fast an F-4 flies.
That's right.
Tell me, we've got about 3 minutes before the next break, Captain, but the other amazing story to me was, now most of the POWs were, pilots, Air Force, Marine, Navy. So all of you, I'm guessing, were college graduates, bachelor's, master's degrees, and you all actually created almost your own little mini community college.
And well, we did. As a matter of fact, when we got back, the University of Maryland gave us credits for the studies that we had over there. You know, without books, without PowerPoints, without professors, we taught each other some of the things that we knew.
And I have trouble wrapping my mind around that, sir. I mean, how that's like learning a whole language one word a day or one word a week with the code. Or were you? Did you do this when you were in groups together?
Both in okay. groups and in solitary confinement. But you know, back to my, you know, back to my original thought that the fact that we had nothing else to do. It would be difficult in a workaday world where you and I have hundreds of thousands of inputs, you know, colors and sounds, but in a prison cell when you have nothing else going on, it was fairly easy to learn these things. And I remember one of the guys taught chemistry and biology, and Joe Milligan. He would lay back on his board bed and just think about chemistry and biology. And his first session lasted about 5 days. But after just laying back and thinking about this thing for 5 or 6 years, he knew everything from protozoa to metazoa and everything in between. He had like a 6-month course in biology and chemistry.
That's amazing, sir. I want to talk a little bit more about that when we come back, but then also the lessons and the wisdom that you're now sharing with other folks based on your captivity there, your 2,000, over 2,000 days as a prisoner of war. Folks, our guest is Charlie Plum. His book is I'm No Hero. Check it out. It's a great read. You can also find out more about Charlie and his story and what he's doing now and how you can learn from it. Check out Charlie Plum, PLUMB.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're very, very pleased to be joined by Charlie Plum. We're talking about his time as a POW in Vietnam. You can find out more, and I encourage you to visit his website, charlieplum.com. Just the pictures and some of the stories there are just pretty amazing. Charlie, on the commercial break, my producer walked in to the studio. We're separated by glass, and he said, you know, if you didn't have this guy on the air, I wouldn't believe some of this stuff. So I'm going to give him your book when I walk out of the studio today and tell him to read it for himself. We're not done, because the thing that really made me go full MacGyver from your book was you almost built your own radio.
I did. As a kid, I was a ham radio operator, so I knew a little bit about building radios. And I early on, I built a crystal set. It's really rudimentary stuff. And I started collecting all the pieces I was going to need. And, you know, I just about got it done. Just wires and, pencil lead actually can serve as the crystal itself. So you can actually tap into radio stations that way. The greatest benefit was just the time it took me to try to put this thing together, because it was probably months that I worked on. I could never figure a way to actually build the sounding mechanism, the headset, if you will, mm-hmm. A speaker for it. And so almost did it, but not quite.
Well, it's still amazing. I mean, again, for someone like me, you know, I took the requisite science courses I had to take to get through college. I took chemistry in high school to meet girls. That was probably not the best decision of my life ever, Charlie. But, you created a way of weighing each other by calculating the weight of displacement of water and tubs, and just, I mean, crazy, crazy stuff. And I encourage folks to read the book to get more examples of this. Charlie, I want to talk a little bit about escapes, because one of the things that I understand happened is you or the leadership in the camps redefined the code of conduct. You went into the camp with a certain code of conduct, but they redefined it to return with honor. Tell us a little bit more about that change and transition and why that was important.
That's probably the magic of the whole situation and why we came back better than had we not been in the prison camp. Interestingly enough, the study is still ongoing where they take us, the ex-POWs of Vietnam, and a control group of pilots that weren't shot down and captured, and they've tested us every year mentally and physically, and they have found that we, the ex-POWs, are healthier mentally and physically than the guys who weren't shot down. And the psychiatrists and psychologists and guys and gals that are a whole lot smarter than I am believe it was because of the leadership that turned this thing around. Jim Stockdale, for instance, would say, hey, there's no whining in this prison camp. We're not being put upon. We're not on the defensive here. We are warriors, and we will fight this battle till our last dying breath. So pull up your big boy pants. You know, we got a war to fight. And he just turned the whole thing around. Now, the code of conduct, I think they recognized early on, was not very realistic, that we weren't able to take the torture and stick with name, rank, show number, date of birth. And so when Jim Stockdale recognized that was an issue, he set up a new game plan and refocused our energy to returning with honor. Now, the first guy that I met on the end of that wire, Bob Shoemaker, I didn't really even want to communicate with him because I didn't want to expose myself, because I felt like any other pilot in that prison camp had probably stuck with a code of conduct. It was stronger than I was a better pilot, was older, was more mature. And so at one point, on the end of this wire, just tugging on this wire in numbers represented letters, I said to him, I said, Shu, I have a confession to make to you. And when I tell you what I did, you might not want to communicate with me anymore, and I'll understand that. Because if our paths were reversed, I wouldn't want to talk to you either if you did what I did. And she said, well, what'd you do, plumber? I said, I broke. I couldn't stick with the code of conduct. So he's tugging on the wire. Of course, this is taking like hours for this discussion. He said, hell, everybody broke. He said, there's not a man in this prison camp who is as strong as he wanted to be. So get over it. He said, you've just joined the finest team you'll ever play on. He said, you will see the best American leadership in this prison camp, bar none. He said, and they have refocused our whole mission here. And so that was the reason, I think, that we survived was, you know, just as you said, it was the leadership there that brought us together and unified that group.
That's really amazing and heartwarming, sir. And I know that even you recount in the book, some of them, people died from the torture, and literally some of your fellow military members were literally driven insane.
And that's true.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk real briefly, because one of the interesting things I learned from your book was the order from the leadership, correct me if I get this wrong, Captain, but not to escape unless you had outside help. And I think that the best data I can find is there were 37 prisoners of war who escaped captivity during the Vietnam period. But it's the impacts upon the other prisoners who remain behind. And you tell some pretty amazing story about what the repercussions were on those folks who remained behind.
It was a personal slap in the face to the Vietnamese. And, they have kind of a different mentality that they just don't want to be embarrassed. And an attempted escape was an embarrassment to the guards and to the officials of the camp. But, and of the 37 escape attempts that you allude to, the vast majority of those were escapes before they actually got to a formalized prison camp. They were, guys were, in trucks and on roads, and right after they were shot down or captured, and a lot more of them actually in South Vietnam, the ground troops down there would be captured, and they were able to escape. But once you were in a formalized prison camp like the ones we were in, escape was almost impossible. And so the leadership actually established what they call a forgot what it was called, like an escape gathering, like a bunch of guys would gather and say, is this going to work? This isn't going to work. And we would pick apart the plan. And I don't know any plan that ever was more than about a 10% probability of success, because we didn't have any outside help. There was no underground in North Vietnam that we could tap into. And so that's the reason why our leadership says no escape without outside help.
Yeah, there's no French resistance running across the countryside there.
Exactly.
Charlie, coming back to those famous Kansas quotes, and doing my research and preparing for the show today, you said something that I just love to death. And you said adversity is a horrible thing to waste. Tell us what you mean by that.
Well, my philosophy, and I think I'm living proof of this philosophy, that every challenge in your life actually is an opportunity. And it's really difficult to explain this to somebody who's going through a tough time in their life. But in reality, even the worst kinds of things can happen to a person. If you search for it, you'll find some nugget of growth, of wisdom. And once you're through an adversity, then you're more confident to face other adversities. So that, you know, my mantra, adversity is a horrible thing to waste, means you waste adversity by blaming other people for your problems, by feeling sorry for yourself, by denying that you have any control of your destiny, and the adversity then becomes very negative. It's a killer. But if you approach adversity and say, okay, this is a puzzle, and I'm going to find out what advantage there is, what asset is within this adversity. And you spend your energy trying to find the positive parts. I'm convinced it's true that every adversity has some kind of advantage.
Now, Charlie, one thing, despite the depravity of your prison keepers, despite the bare minimum of life's essentials you had, I'm guessing the one thing that you still controlled was yourself and your spirit. And that was communicated through, let's just say, some classic American hand gestures on occasion to your captors. But that idea transferred to your average civilian out there, the fact that you still have control. How important is that in the messages you share with people out there?
I think it's vital. You know, I'm still on the speaking circuit. I'll probably speak 85 times this year. And that's what I tell the audiences is, hey, don't give away your choice. Accept the fact that you can decide. You can't decide what's happening to you, but you can certainly decide on your response to what's happening to you. And so even in the depths of despair, if you really feel like that you have some kind of an advantage and you make the right choices, you're going to come out and make any situation into a positive situation.
Wonderful. Sir, when we come back, we've got one more segment left. I want to kind of harken back to the classics and talk a little bit about who packed your parachute. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined by Captain Charlie Plum. Almost 6 years in captivity in Vietnam, and he's got just amazing wisdom and lessons to share with us as a result of that experience. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio. Ladies and gentlemen, we're joined on the phone by Charlie Plum, Captain Charlie Plum. Just one of the amazing speakers brought to us by Bravo 748 Military and Veterans Speakers Bureau. You can find out more at bravo748.com. Charlie's website is charlieplumb.com. Charlie, I tell you, what really I think the first time I became acquainted with your story might have actually been something my father, who's a minister, used from the pulpit. And if you just Google this, you'll find it everywhere. I hope you've got the copyright on it. But it's the idea of who packed your chute, who packed your parachute. And that is just such a powerful message that everybody out there can use. Tell us the story behind that message.
Several years after I was released from prison camps in Vietnam, I was in a restaurant in Kansas City where I used to live. A fellow came up to me and said, you're Charlie Plum. I said, yes, I am. He said, you're that guy. You flew jet fighters in Vietnam. You're a fighter pilot, part of that Top Gun outfit. You were shot down off the aircraft carrier Kitty Hawk. You parachuted in enemy territory. You were tortured, and you spent nearly 6 years as a prisoner of war. Well, I dumbfounded. I said, how in the world did you know all that? He said, I'm the parachute rigger that packed your parachute. So there's a tradition in the Navy that whenever you use somebody's parachute, you buy them a bottle. And so I buy this guy the obligatory bottle, and we talk into the night about parachute packing. A very humble guy. And his point was, hey, I'm not the only guy that packed your parachute. Yeah, I did the physical job, but your survival in that prison camp depended on your mom, your dad, your preacher, your Boy Scout leader, your buddies at the Naval Academy. A lot of people packed your mental, your psychological, your spiritual parachute even more than I did, and that was the reason that you survived. And so I tell that story publicly and ask people who packs your parachute. You know, who do you need to thank? Because I was really embarrassed and really frustrated, because that night when I went to bed, I thought to myself, how many times might I have passed that parachute rigger in the halls of the passageways of that ship? How many times might I have seen him on Liberty? And I never said boo, because he was a sailor. You know, I was an officer. You know, and I felt very, very guilty by not thanking him until the day that I actually used his parachute and he saved my life. And I think that we go through life that way. You know, so many people are responsible for our success and our achievements that we never really thank. So I made it a point to try to go back and thank the coaches and thank the parents and community leaders that actually gave me those nuggets that I was going to need when it going got tough.
And Charlie, I would like to believe that today you're helping our listeners pack their parachute in your own way. I try and do as much research as possible before I even throw a very professional guest like you on the air. There was a podcast, and it's called Team Never Quit. And I thought that was such just the name of the podcast was so appropriate for someone like you and what you went through and what you continue to do and what you share with others. Let me ask you this, the triumph of the human spirit that is so obvious in your survival and your fellow POW's survival and guys like Lee Ellis, who we've had on the show and talk about what it took to get through that, it's an essential element in that survival. But Charlie, what about people who feel broken in spirit out there? What would your advice be to them?
Well, first of all, again, with the philosophy that, hey, you control your life. If your spirit is broken, it's not because of the gal that divorced you. You know, it's not because of the officer that wouldn't promote you. When your spirit is broken, you know, you still have a choice. And if you can look at it as an opportunity, invariably, if something happened to you to break your spirit, you will find, it may take years, but you will find that it was actually an advantage to be broken down. See, I'm convinced that everybody in life, needs to come to grips, with the fact that we're all human, okay, and we make mistakes. But we also recover from those mistakes. And sometimes I wish I could put people in a POW camp just to show them that, you know, there's life after adversity. There's reason for being put to the test. But, and I know that many of your listeners are military people, and I'd like to take a little bit of an opportunity to say thanks, because as I run around the country and speak, you know, people will say, thanks for your service, thanks for your service. And I appreciate that. And I say thank you for saying that. But I want to pass that along to anybody with a broken spirit, that there are millions of people, and I've met hundreds of thousands of them, that really believe in the military and really believe that we are contributing to a better life for all Americans.
No question, sir. And that, you know, that's really why I opened the way I opened the show is like you, there's things I love about our country, and sometimes I get frustrated, like a parent who has a child who I know can do better in school. One of my frustrations is just how quick we are to overlook just the amazing gift that we've been given by freedom. And, you know, I'd like to think that some of these folks around the world who are downloading this podcast who don't enjoy those freedoms will take some inspiration from that as well. So, and we owe it all to those men and women, yourselves, generations before you, generations after you, who continue to stand the watch.
Absolutely. And when I talk to young groups, you know, I say, you guys and gals absolutely won the lottery. You know, look what you've got. Like no place else on earth, you know, you have the freedom to achieve your dreams. Anything you can dream, you can achieve, because you're in America. I went back to Vietnam 4 years ago, and I toured the country, both north and south, found wonderful people there, spoke English and wanted to be my friends. At the end of my trip, it was just me, and I'd sent my family home, me in a park, ran into a lady who was missing her leg, her entire leg, and I sat down on a park bench and talked to her and asked her how she lost her leg. She said, linebacker two. And linebacker two was a secret code word for the B-52 bombings at Christmas of 1972. And so I said, you speak excellent English. Why aren't you a docent at a museum? Why aren't you an interpreter? She said, my country would never give me a permit to do something like that because I'm an invalid. And so, and this gal was selling postcards in the park to stay alive. And I'm thinking to myself, we got two people on this park bench, both scarred by the same war, and one of them has two planes, two boats, drives a big car, runs around the world, has a wonderful wife and four kids and three grandkids, and she is eking out a life selling postcards. And I'm thinking, and she's at least as smart as I am. So I'm thinking the only difference in that lady in the park and Charlie Plum is that we are in a different culture, that I have the ability. I mean, you know, my government, you know, takes care of wounded people. Mm-hmm. My government gives me the opportunity to achieve, and hers did not. And that was the only difference.
Charlie, you are a true professional. You've spoken to over 4,000 groups, I think, over the course of your career. Unfortunately, our talk is coming to an end because you are such a professional. I'll tell you what, we got 1 minute, your opportunity to close.
All right. Well, I just want to get the message out. First of all, thanks for the people that are listening to this that are in uniform. Thanks for those who are listening to this who support people in uniform, because we have this responsibility. It's our God-given responsibility. It's a wonderful responsibility of protecting the rights and the freedoms that we have. And so my message would be, go forth, pack some parachutes, believe that you can make a difference in the world.
I tell you what, I'm going to talk to you after this show, Charlie, because I want to share a personal story that we're just, you've impacted my life already. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Thanks so much to Captain Charlie Plum for joining us today. You can learn more, visit charlieplum.com. Please get his book and read it, I'm No Hero. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, don't forget all these podcasts at AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Follow us on Facebook. We've got a Twitter feed at Warrior Radio TUC. Also, check out Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. If you'd like to support our continued growth of these messages, visit that Patreon page and find out how you can invest in doing so. Until next time, all policies and procedures are to remain in place. Take care.
You've been listening to American Warrior Radio. You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.